everybody. This is Leonard Maltin, and you're listening to Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn, which means you're also listening to...
Baron Vaughn.
Yeah.
That's me, the other guy.
We're both here and happy to be. And we're going to do something a little different today because we're discussing three documentaries.
Right. And when it comes to documentaries, you don't want to spend too much time dwelling on the bad ones.
No, it seems not only pointless, literally pointless, when there's so many good documentaries out there. I mean, we've really been blessed.
Yeah.
There's been a flood of worthwhile, provocative, interesting, compelling documentaries in recent years. I guess some of that has to do with the new channels of distribution.
Absolutely. Especially when it comes to streaming services.
Exactly.
People are hungry for documentaries.
Mm-hmm. And the fact that it now is feasible to make a documentary on a modest budget. I mean, you can, and people have made them on their iPhones, for goodness sake. I mean, and you can edit on your Final Cut Pro at home, you know, on your laptop. Now, that doesn't mean that they're necessarily good.
It just means that it's a simpler means of the production of a documentary is simple in terms of filmmaking.
Yes.
In terms of organizing everything and what you're going to do a documentary about, that's difficult.
And of course, and one of the big hurdles has always been distribution. And
right.
Now that has been largely solved. And then you have this other incredible development of crowdfunding, crowdsourcing. Amazing.
Yeah, like Kickstarter and Indiegogo.
Yeah, all that stuff.
GoFundMe.
I have friends and acquaintances and talented people who have made it possible to complete their films, either launch or complete their films because of public support. $5 here, $10 here, $100 here, $1,000 there. It's heartwarming to see.
So if you are a person who has one time donated to any of these campaigns, thanks.
Yeah, good for you. Good for you because you help us. You give us good films to watch. And can I do a little spiel here? Will you indulge me?
I don't even know why you're asking.
Well,
spiel it away.
When I show documentaries at my class at USC, which is a big class of 360 students in our theater, Norris Theater.
And don't – that's not counting the wait list.
We show all kinds of movies. And it's a very diverse audience. It's not just film students. In fact, the majority are not film majors or aspiring filmmakers. So we have young people from all parts of the campus, athletes, English majors, business majors, all the way down the line. But I always tell them that I want to make them a smarter audience. That's my big goal, to expose them to films they might not otherwise see and to help them understand what makes them tick. And we are lucky enough to have the filmmakers there as guests after the screenings. So I always try to show at least one documentary every semester and usually succeed. And we've had some very good ones and some okay ones. But
that's still an interesting class to see an okay one and then have to discuss it afterwards.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, to me, it's never dull to listen to the filmmaker after you've watched the film. That's
right.
Me.
Okay.
I can't speak for the kid who's sleeping in row 7, but but for me, it's always interesting.
Oh, your class has 7 rows. Okay. That's a humble brag. Continue.
No. More than 7. So one early on, I've been doing it 17 years, early on, the whole football squad was attending, and they all clustered in the back of the room to be as far from me as possible in the auditorium. In any case.
And every now and then they would just chant
but
Rudy.
I digress. Yeah, right. The point I'm trying to make is that I try to give them a sense of what is a documentary because that term – some people think the term is outmoded and in fact, misleading. Because documentary implies document, which implies objectivity.
Right.
A fact. The Declaration of Independence is a document. We can all agree on that. We all agree on what it contains.
Yeah.
We can interpret it different ways, but we agree on what it is and that it exists.
You can't disagree that it is a document.
Correct.
It's literally a document.
There it is. And so as an extension of that word, documentary implies reportage.
Mm-hmm.
But it ain't true. And that's why some people prefer nonfiction filmmaking or even direct cinema. I've heard many different
– a lot of different terms being thrown around, yeah.
Proposed, you know, redefinitions or euphemisms. But the truth is every documentary has a point of view. No documentary is objective. Even a film that is on a historical subject on which there's little or no controversy still is completely dependent on the decisions made by the filmmaker. Are you showing this person in close-up or in a long shot? That affects the impact of the shot. What aren't you showing?
Exactly.
What are you leaving out?
That's where a lot of documentaries fall into debate, especially when they are on an important issue, like a social issue or political idea. Some people go like, well, they're leaving out the such and such and such.
Exactly. It's choices. A documentarian is making choices in every single shot, every sequence, almost every frame of a movie.
And the editing.
And the editing primarily. And so, yes, some are more subjective than others. I mean, Michael Moore doesn't make any pretense.
Right. He's in it.
He's doing
– I'm
what,
here.
He's doing what I would call personal journalism or advocacy filmmaking, though it comes under the umbrella of documentary because that's where it happens to fall.
Right.
Ken Burns, with his historical – documentaries, you think of as more of a traditional documentarian, but he too
is innovative,
is expressing a point of view. He is a creative artist.
Mm-hmm.
He's making judgments that affect how we receive the information and what information we do receive. So there's all kinds of films that come into this arena. We're going to discuss three today that have something in common. Karen and I were just talking about this. They ultimately have something important in common, thematically.
Yeah.
But each film is individual.
Yeah. They're all about community, mm-hmm. but different ways to see a community or how a community can be affected by the people and policies, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. And we think they're all worthwhile. We think they're really, really worth seeing and for a variety of reasons. And two of them are, let's face it, tough.
Tough is an understatement.
Yeah, tough to watch at times, but I think rewarding.
Yes.
You're rewarded for the time you invest and the emotions that you invest in these films. And the last one, I find a very moving film. And
all of them will make you cry.
Yeah.
But for different reasons.
Yeah. The first one, I have to say, the first one hit me like a punch in the gut.
Do tell.
The Overnighters, one of my favorite films, one of my favorite documentary films for sure of last year, 2014. And it played at the Sundance Film Festival originally, where it won a special jury prize for intuitive filmmaking.
What does that even mean, intuitive filmmaking?
Well, that's part of, you know, one of the things about docs, too, that's interesting is sometimes the story about the making of the documentary
is compelling.
Is sometimes just as compelling.
Yeah.
Or in some cases, even more compelling than the film itself. They almost go hand in hand. And this is such a case because it was made by a young fellow named Jesse Moss. And when I say it was made by him, he did it himself.
Mm.
I mean, when it came to post-production, when it came to, you know, editing and score. Well, I don't know if there's a score on the film, actually.
Not really. Not a lot of music.
Yeah. But when it came to assembling, finishing, completing the film, of course, he had help. He had assistance. And I'm sure in some of the planning stages, he called on different people. But what he did, he read about a town called Williston, North Dakota.
That was being overcome with essentially migrant workers.
It was becoming a boom town.
Yeah.
North Dakota has had a mushrooming economy in recent years because of what we commonly refer to as fracking. The oil industry has hit big time.
And we're not talking about Battlestar Galactica.
No.
We're talking about shale, gas. Continue, Leonard.
And so what it's become is a magnet for people, mostly men,
who are looking for work.
We're looking for work, and they're coming from all points, northeast, south, and west, because it's kind of like the gold rush of 49.
Yes.
I've heard There's gold and then there are hills. In other words, there's jobs.
There's jobs and then there are hills, the hills of North Dakota.
That's right. And these people, these men, some of them have left their families behind to come to this promised land of Williston where they can get jobs, make some money, send money home to their families.
And also get jobs when they are – they might not be the most educated people around.
Right.
They might have some stuff in their past that's hard to get, you know, off mm-hmm. of job resumes, but it's not about that in this place. Like, if you need a job, you can go there and very possibly get a very high-paying job.
Right. Except that when we join the story, as we join the story, that golden moment has passed. The jobs are taken. They're filled. The hotel and motel rooms are filled. The waitressing jobs are filled. There's nothing for them, and yet they're still coming.
There's unprecedented growth in a way that the city can't meet.
So there's this fellow, Jim Reinke, who's a Lutheran pastor, local church, and he finds himself confronted with this reality of men showing up and being turned away from employment, turned away from potential housing. Some of them came with a few bucks in their pocket, but most of them don't have anything. They came here to get something, and it's not there for them. So he feels that the only Christian, the right and Christian thing to do is to at least give them a helping hand. The least he can do is give them shelter at night. They can sleep in sleeping bags in his church in the different rooms, in the classrooms, in anywhere there's space.
And some of the people who have cars can sleep in the church parking lot.
Right. He can provide them with a meal in the morning. He can at least give them some basics so that they can survive while they're there in Williston.
You might say he was practicing Christianity.
Exactly. And he seems like not only like a good man, a good and decent man, but an incredibly caring man and a guy who asserts his feelings very strongly. And at first, now we don't want to give away too much here, but we're not no spoilers here yet. At first, his congregants agree with his idea. They say, yes, you're right. You know, we should be lending this helping hand. And we're not in love with the idea, but it's the right thing to do. Let's face it, it is the right thing to do.
And then it becomes, when is this going to stop? How long are we doing this?
Right.
There's too many people.
Yeah.
I'm losing my community.
Right.
I'm losing my church, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And not all the fellows who've shown up are wholesome, clean-cut, necessarily trustworthy fellows. And because they're strangers, and some of them do have checkered pasts, it makes a lot of the people in the community of Williston uncomfortable, extremely uncomfortable.
And the overnighters is what they start calling them.
Yep. That's the starting point of this film. What makes it so interesting from a behind-the-scenes point of view is that Jesse Moss went there by himself.
Mm.
No sound man. No cameraman, no crew, no assistants, just him. Why did he go? He says he went because he read about this place and he said boomtowns are inherently interesting places.
They are.
There's got to be a good story here, at least one good story here, and maybe a multiplicity of good stories here. That's what led him there. Okay, he was right. But he also, I think, instinctively understood that if he came with a guy with a boom mic and another guy with a camera that he had to sort of give instructions to, come in tighter here, move the camera over here, wait, can you say that again, that it wouldn't work. He had to ingratiate himself into this community, live there, and gain the trust of the people he wanted to document. And by being alone, quiet, discreet, he did. First, of course, the pastor, first and foremost. The pastor's family, his wife, children, and then people in the community and the overnighters themselves. And you sometimes wonder as you watch, at least I do as I watch films like this, you have to ask yourself, why and how did these people allow themselves to be not exploited, exposed? Why and how did they allow themselves to expose themselves so nakedly, so openly on camera?
Yeah.
And of course, the answers are many, and we don't know for sure what all the answers are. Part of it is, I guess, people want to tell their stories. People want to have their stories told. They may not realize it immediately, but they do in so many cases.
And I think a lot of the people in this documentary, they understand that they're in a boom town, mm-hmm. that there's some cultural event that is taking place that they are at the center of.
Mm-hmm.
So they want to document of
yeah.
it. They want to see what happens, but they also have no idea
yeah.
what's going to happen because they're living their lives. So yeah. I assume they all thought this was going to go differently.
Well, that's the other aspect of the film that is so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many unexpected twists and turns in this story. We've given you the setup.
Yeah.
All we've given
we've
you is the setup.
Told you nothing else.
And we're not going to reveal much more because you really ought to experience it for yourself. And think about what it takes for a guy like the filmmaker Jesse Moss to go there and to invest his time. I mean, he's not wealthy. He wasn't funded. He had a little money saved up. He and his wife had saved a few bucks. But he went there hoping to get a movie, hoping there'd be a story worth telling. He didn't know. And he didn't know what the story might be, what the central story might be, and where it might lead. And where it leads, folks, you can't anticipate. I don't think you can. I couldn't. Could you?
No, not at all. And that's where I start to also be like, how did he get all of this? Because he just said, like, you know what? Don't tell me what you're going to – like, just let me know when you yeah. – he's not trying to influence anyone. He just let right. it unfold.
Right. Without judgment.
Without judgment, yes.
That's another key to the film. Everything that happens is – and we were going on faith here that he is telling us this story honestly and fully. Is he? I think he is.
Mm-hmm.
They had screenings in Williston, actually, after it opened last year. Yes,
oh,
wouldn't
wow.
that have been fascinating?
Yes.
They did have screenings, and the filmmaker was there for Q&A. That would have been really interesting to witness.
I bet a bunch of people did not like how they came off.
Yeah. Well, people, we never see ourselves
of course.
Really as we are.
Of course. We're living our lives from inside, first person, and then
yeah.
when you see it outside, you're like, what? That's what I did?
Or, yeah, exactly.
That is not what I did.
But, I mean, what guts, what gumption it takes to go. I call these films of discovery because the filmmaker is taking a big risk. Well, principally of their time. But time is money. And if you're trying to make or eke out a living as a filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's a really important investment of time. And what if you come away empty-handed? What if it doesn't pan out? What if the people aren't so interesting?
Then you just wasted, quote-unquote, wasted a lot of time.
Exactly.
But that is not the case.
Not the case here.
For Jesse Moss, who was intuitive with his filmmaking.
Yes.
Hence an award.
You know, it's a very layered film, very provocative. And so intimate, my gosh.
Very, very
uncomfortably intimate at times.
And people, and all of these people in this film, they seem to have a very clear idea of themselves
yeah.
and what they're trying to do, to the point that they no longer have a clear idea of themselves and what they're trying to do.
It reminded me that we shouldn't rush to judgment about anybody. You know, we're all in search of answers in our lives. And some of us are luckier than others to find them or to find them the right ones at the right time. Boy.
Because these are interesting men who have come up to Williston.
Yeah.
Like they're all in a position where they do not have a job, and this is the best idea that they have heard of for years.
Yeah.
So all these people with their different stories and their different backgrounds are there rubbing up against the people who are like, oh, I lost my community.
Yeah.
Woo, boomtown.
Yeah.
To say the least.
If ever a film made me think, there but for the grace of God go I, it is The Overnighters. It really, really got to me. It got to me, Baron.
Oh, yeah.
In a way not many films do.
Because, you know, when you said the gold rush, that's exactly, this is a story that has happened in this country a lot.
Yeah.
And fascinating film. All right. So that's we've said enough.
That's our number one.
The Overnighters.
The Overnighters, released by Draft House Films, the people who also run the Alamo Draft House movie chain.
Yes.
They have good taste. They acquire interesting movies.
I've been to all of those places. They're delicious because they serve you food at the seats.
Yes, they do. They're going to open here in L.A. next year.
Oh, know? No. Oh, goodbye seeing movies anywhere else.
They're opening downtown as part of a new complex. It's going to be a square block of
I've been reading.
Retail and housing.
I've been reading about that. Broadway sort of trying to.
Somewhere down there.
Quote, unquote, develop the city.
Yeah, yeah. It's going to be a 9-screen theater.
Phew.
So get ready. Anyway, that's number one. You can find it online, folks. You can.
It's on Netflix.
It's on Netflix. The Overnighters.
Actually, all of the films we're talking about today are on Netflix.
And other sources as well.
And other sources. But I watch them all on Netflix.
All right.
Why do I have a affinity for Netflix? I wonder why.
Well, you pay once and you don't have to pay again.
Yeah, that's true.
That's nice.
Plus, they're my other boss. Anyway, continue.
So that gets us off to a good start because we're so enthusiastic about this film. And now the next film we're going to discuss is one that I didn't know about, to my embarrassment, because I should have. And Baron proposed it to me, and he said, now you folks, we love your feedback. We really appreciate your feedback. And more than one person has said, why do you guys always have to agree? Why can't you sometimes disagree or debate? Well, we're not opposed to the idea. When we came into this podcast, we wanted to be positive, and we wanted to mostly discuss
things we enjoy, and things we like,
and things we recommend.
Yes,
because that's the other feedback we get from you guys is that you like getting recommendations. You like being told, "Oh, that's a film I ought to see. Good, I'll put that on my to-do list or my queue."
That said, you are not privy to the emails that Leonard and I send. That's my personal entertainment, where we sometimes do disagree.
It happens.
Yeah, and then but we come to an agreement. But what were you going to say? I said something in
the
email.
Well, you proposed this particular film, and I didn't know it. I quickly looked it up and saw, oh, it was made by that fellow. All right, that's interesting. And I said, oh, this is not going to be a fun night at the movies when I saw the subject matter. But I thought, well, if you feel that strongly about it, I'll give it a try. I'm really glad I did. What film might that be? He said, pausing for emphasis.
Oh, goodness.
And possible suspense. We'll tell you in just a minute.
You just got maltened. Welcome back to Malton on Movies with Baron Vaughn. That person over there is Leonard Malton, and
that's
I
me.
Am Baron Vaughn.
And I still am Leonard Malton.
You still are?
Yes.
That is true.
At last reconnoitering, yes.
Okay, good.
So why don't you lead us into this one, since this was your proposal?
Yes, and I stumbled upon this documentary a couple of years ago. I was in Canada. Tricking the internet into thinking I was in the United States so I could use certain streaming services, not as easy as it once was. Mm-hmm. And I stumbled upon this this podcast, this documentary, I mean to say. And I grew up in Las Vegas, Nevada. Some of you might know that. Some of you might not. But while I was in Vegas, we had an influx. We imported gangs from the Los Angeles area. So some of the neighborhoods that I grew up, there were gang activity. There were some gangs that were – and these are different than the organized gangs that created Las Vegas. These are street gangs. I'm talking about the brand names of street gangs, the Bloods and the Crips. And it has been – those are two words that have been in my brain for as long as I can remember of who to fear and who to avoid. And I knew a lot of kids growing up that got involved. And it was something I fortunately stayed away from and was able to be here on this podcast today. But I wasn't in a really, really bad situation. They were around, but it wasn't an inescapable situation. I had options and I took some of those options. A lot of people do not get that opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And when I saw this documentary, which the title is Bloods and Crips Made in America.
Oh, Crips and Bloods.
Is it Crips and Bloods?
Yeah. Yeah.
Uh-oh. See, that's the other thing. It's like Laurel and Hardy. Hardy and Laurel. Crips and Bloods Made in America. I think I said it because of the B and the C, so I went alphabetical. But the title in itself, because it says – because it's made in America, was provocative. The title in itself made me go, what? This might be an interesting, scathing report to watch and to be – and maybe it'll be informative and entertaining. Definitely informative. Entertaining, I'll substitute heartbreaking for entertaining. So that's what this documentary is about.
And historically valuable.
Yes.
That's what impressed me the most, I think. So as I say, I did not grow up in this culture. I grew up on the other coast. I grew up in a very nice sort of prototypical post-World War II baby boom suburban town of New Jersey outside of New York City. And all this was alien, foreign to me.
Across the country, literally.
I remember reading about the Watts riots of 1965. I didn't read extensively, but I remember being aware of them, as I was of the, you know, the burgeoning civil rights movement in general. But I didn't really have any understanding as an adolescent of what was going on and why. What I admire about this film is not just how well it tells its story and takes us inside this world, but gives us a historical context.
Absolutely.
A background. How did all this come about? Why did all this come about?
And that's what sets it apart.
Yeah.
From a lot of other things that are about this subject matter, is that this filmmaker, Stacia Peralta, really sets the context of what was the environment that created these two most infamous street gangs in American culture.
And I think the background point that's interesting is that he really wants to know the answer himself.
Yes.
He grew up here and, in fact, has an interesting background of his own because he was in on the first generation of skateboarding. He became one of the first professional skateboarders, a guy who commercialized his passion for skateboarding. Mm.
I did not know any of this.
And in fact, wound up making a film that's got a lot of acclaim and prizes called Dogtown and Z-Boys.
Oh, that's the same person.
Yep, okay. Same guy. And that was his first film. I don't know if it's his first film, but that was his first prominent film.
Yeah, big film.
And got the Audience Award and the Director's Award at the Sundance Film Festival back in 2001. But he had a son he was raising, and he was troubled by this gang culture that existed not so far from where he lived. What was it about? Why did it happen? Where did it come from? And that led him to make this film. So I think this too is sort of a film of discovery for him, trying to understand. And maybe that's why I could relate to it so well, because he's my ombudsman. He's my avatar in the film, taking me through this topic. And he starts on a great note because he interviews these three older guys who've seen it all, who've lived through the whole story, the whole process of the beginning of a black community in L.A. in the 1940s, when blacks left the South in vast numbers for the
right.
first time.
Went to New
Not
York
just to
or
come
Chicago.
To L.A., but Detroit, moved yeah. everywhere because there was work. So many.
And less racism.
Yes. Well, and because they were needed. So many men especially were off at war around the globe. Mostly white, but black men too, fighting the war. And there was need for manpower, literal manpower, in the munitions factories and the weapons factories,
It caused a mass migration.
Yep.
Very much like the overnighters.
Right.
Where, you know, black people were coming to Los Angeles in droves.
Right. These guys came here, these folks came here, and there was work, there was good work. There was the possibility, not only possibility, but
the reality
that they could earn a good living, buy a house on a nice street.
Raise a family. Have food in the fridge.
Yep.
Bills paid. A car.
Now, the realtors and the powers that be made sure that they were only shown houses in one particular area of LA.
Very much contained.
Redlining, I think they call it in the real estate world. But these were not slums. These were perfectly nice neighborhoods. And the people took pride in their neighborhoods and in their homes. And, you know, and they were integrated, small I, not big I.
Okay,
into the fabric of Los Angeles.
Yes, okay. Integrated into the fabric of Los Angeles, but segregated as a neighborhood.
Exactly so. And what these guys start to the picture these fellows start to paint is that they thought things were fine. They didn't really encounter racism when they were young, not when they were kids. But one of them tells a quietly heartbreaking story of being taken by his mother to join a Boy Scout troop, or a Cub Scout troop, I think. And being told by the leader, I'm awfully sorry, but this is a white troop.
Right.
And I think other parents would be uncomfortable with your son being part of it. And that's when he started to learn the reality. And this fellow who is telling this story decades later, still here to tell the tale, explains that that's when some of his friends, his schoolmates, his
neighborhood
pals,
boys and girls,
started forming clubs, not gangs, clubs.
Social clubs.
Yep.
Like the Slossons, which is a street.
Right.
And that was thought of as the original club.
Yep. And they, because they wanted to belong and they wanted to be cool. And they did. And even that was okay because they were not destructive. They were not violent.
It wasn't about violence. It was about fisticuffs.
Yeah.
He's like, you'd get knocked out, but that was it.
And so you see the birth of this movement, if you want to call it that, a culture. But then they also learned at their peril that they could not leave their proscribed neighborhood.
They were being policed.
By the notorious Chief Parker of the LAPD.
Horrible man.
And
horrible man.
And that if they crossed Alameda, is that what it was? If they crossed Alameda Street or Avenue, they were in
the wrong neighborhood.
Verboten territory.
Yeah, so keep them contained was essentially the directive given to the police. And so these people were, you know, policed within an inch of their lives, constantly being hassled, constantly
yep.
being bothered. What are you doing in this neighborhood? Because they lived there.
Yeah.
That's why they're there, you know, just, you know, as we sometimes say, driving while black. That was enough to get them hassled.
Yeah.
And one hassle too many, the tensions grew and grew and grew.
Right. This at the same time that the civil rights movement is flowering, mushrooming, I guess is the better word, mushrooming, all over the U.S., mid-60s. So again, we don't want to give away the whole film.
Right. And this is only a tiny piece.
Yeah.
Because we're talking about the film, the way that this story is told. There's a lot of flashbacking.
Yeah.
So the information that we're telling you is chronologically first, but it's shown in different pieces in the film. And it's actually quite innovative how he decides to reveal this context information.
Yeah, it's very smart, savvy storytelling in that sense. And again, you have to say to yourself, as I did anyway, why did these people open up to Stacy Peralta, the filmmaker? Who incidentally is white. Why did they trust him with their stories? Why were they willing to be so candid? Why did they think he would be honest? Which they obviously did.
Yeah.
Did he show them his earlier film?
Possibly.
We don't know.
I think it's that – the people in this film legitimately want a way out. Mm-hmm. These are either people who have gotten out, or these are people who want a way out, but they want their Tory sold. They want their story told.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating, compelling, scary, heartbreaking, heart-wrenching story. The theme that Leonard and I were discussing before the podcast, I think, is community. Mm-hmm. That unites all of these three podcasts. The third we'll get to in a little bit. But The Overnighters is about a community that cannot agree on what a community is supposed to be, mm-hmm. as I see it. Crips and Bloods is about a community twice destroyed, mm-hmm. where a community started to be a community, they were destroyed. Then out of those ashes was born another community that tried to be something, that tried to stand for something, and they were destroyed. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly the third community that grew out of that, twice the ashes, was charred, was scarred, and was scary, and was looking for some sort of guidance. And unfortunately, it became about territory and guns and death. And it's a tragic – oh, see, I'm getting emotional.
Well, it's emotional stuff.
It's emotional stuff. I personally connect to it a lot. Black, some of you have guessed it by now. But anyway.
And is it revealing too much to say that there is a note of hope at the end of the movie?
I don't think so.
Yeah, there is.
There's a note of hope.
And it's not false hope.
Yeah.
And it's not unrealistic hope.
See, that's the thing, especially with a story like this. It's so dark mm-hmm. and real, really real, that sometimes it could be hokey when they kind of end on a light note. But this doesn't feel hokey.
No.
And there's a lot that's being done. And I mean, just see it.
It's a hell of a film. And again, Peralta doesn't insert himself into the film, although every now and then you hear his off-camera voice posing a question to someone on camera. And it's so interesting to see how these people respond. Young people, old people alike. Ones who've been around for decades, ones who came into this, were born into this.
Yeah.
Many were born into this.
They don't even know why the fight's raging. They just know they're a part of it.
No.
But it's a war zone.
But there are people who want to break this chain of violence. And so it does end on that note. And thank goodness. It's still there. It's still happening.
Yeah, the work is not finished, but there's work being done. Very good work, and this film is part of it, I think.
I read somewhere that he worked on this over 15 years' time, and I can believe it. And I'm sure a lot of that period was not just doing research, and archival research, finding old photographs, old family snapshots, which are very well used too. And news footage and all of that. But trust, building bonds of trust with the people who really needed to tell the story. There are a couple of places I wish he had a few different or additional talking heads, I'll confess.
Okay.
But I think on the whole, it's very effective and very powerful, very powerful. It aired on PBS's Independent Lens. Some of you may have even seen it that way when it originated. But gosh, it's a film to see. It really is.
And if you're a person out there who is curious about a lot of the racial goings on in the country as of late, there's always a cause and effect. And this is a film that shows how that cause and effect affects things.
Right. And how our society, unfortunately, to this day, looks for Band-Aids instead of causes, instead of root causes, and wants to attack the symptoms that are present now instead of preventative actions to stop it from happening in the first place.
Right. Nobody is it's the difference between taking a pill to make your back feel better and exercising so that way you grow some muscles around your back or figure out a way to support yourself.
Anyway, Crips and Bloods, made in America. I'm glad you suggested I watch it.
You're welcome. And you're welcome, listeners.
And we're going to leave you with another film that might be considered our sleeper.
These are all kind of sleepers.
These are all kind of sleepers. And this one is very moving as well, but also very inspiring, deep down. Not inspiring the way those headlines in the movie ads say, inspiring, you'll love it. You know, no, no. This really is an inspiring film about two remarkable people separated in age by more than 60 years. And they will win your heart, I dare say. We'll tell you about that film in just a moment. Welcome back to Maltin on Movies with Baron Vaughn.
I'm Baron Vaughn.
I'm Leonard Maltin. And we do welcome you back. And we do welcome your involvement and participation and feedback and support, goodness knows.
Leave reviews. Tell your friends, all of your friends.
We love it.
Heck, tell a couple businesses that need someone to promote them on podcasts.
Because we're here.
Tell them to get in touch with Wolf Pop. We're here.
We're here.
We're here.
Last summer, I was invited to see a film called, an early screening of a film called Keep On Keepin' On. All I knew about it was that the executive producer was Quincy Jones, the imposing and impressive Quincy Jones, and that it involved one of my favorite jazz musicians, the great Clark Terry. And so I was ready. Now, my wife came with me to the screening. My wife is not a big jazz buff, as I am. But it turns out that the film is only kind of incidentally about jazz.
Okay, yeah.
It's not a jazz film. It's about two people who exist in the jazz world.
Community,
but it's about
jazz community.
Jazz community, thank you. But it's about these two remarkable people. When we meet them, Clark Terry is in his late 80s, one of the acknowledged masters of jazz music, of jazz education.
Yeah, one of the greatest trumpet players of all time.
Of all
and
time.
Also heralded as one of the greatest jazz teachers
yep.
of all time.
He's in residence at William Patterson College in New Jersey, teaching master classes, leading their band. He meets an 18-year-old piano prodigy named Justin Coughlin, who is blind. And somehow or other, these two people connect. They connect in a very personal way. Part of it is because of the sight. Clark is starting to lose some of his vision. And Justin, who lost it when he was a boy, actually, is a remarkably upbeat, positive fellow, gives off an incredible positive energy, and has prodigious talent. Gosh, he's just great. He's
an incredible piano player.
And the two of them fuel each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's so interesting. It's not just an old master passing on his lessons to a youngster. That would be one story, but that's not this story. This is a story about two people who seemingly have little in common, but in fact form a precious and valuable bond that's a two-way street. And that's what makes it so interesting.
Clark is enlivened and emboldened
yep.
by Justin's his youth, his energy, his mm-hmm. talent, and also how well Justin can learn from him and takes what he has to say. And
absorbs his lessons.
Absorbs
yeah.
his lessons, but then also gives so much back,
right.
so much love and attention and friendship.
When we say lessons, we're not talking about music lessons necessarily. We're talking about life lessons.
But are they different?
No, that's the point that Clark keeps making over and over and over again. If your life isn't right, if you don't have your head straight, if you don't have your priorities in order, you're not going to be a good musician. You're not going to play well. You're not going to play from the heart. You're not going to be able to express yourself mm-hmm. meaningfully. And that's a lot of what this film is about. I spent a little time, as it turns out, with the young director, Alan Hicks, and the producer, Paula Dupre-Pessman. And Paula, who has great credentials, she was involved in films like The Cove, you know, high-profile documentary films. She sort of sat on Alan, who is a jazz musician himself, a jazz drummer, who also attended that college. That's where he met both of these people.
Of course.
She encouraged him, cut back on the jazz excerpts. You don't want to make this just for music buffs. And you don't want to sort of turn off people who aren't interested in hearing jazz. Focus on the people. Make this about these two remarkable people, and that will communicate to a wider, broader audience. I'm sure it was tough for a musician to cut out
amazing music.
Amazing music, but I think it was a smart idea. It was a very canny idea. Alan Hicks is an Australian surfer dude who'd never made a film in his life.
Wow.
Had never picked up a camera.
Wow.
It's, again, the backstory is just amazing. But he fell in love with Clark Terry as a student of his, became friendly with young Justin Coughlin as a fellow student, and decided this was a story that had to be told. He recruited a pal of his, a fellow Aussie, who had been doing some camera work. And the two of them spent 5 years.
Oof.
5 years. Not every single day of those 5 years. But over 5 years' time, they virtually moved in with Clark Terry and his wife Gwen in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, where they live. And then spent a great deal of time with Justin, who's from Virginia, and who moved to New York City at one point to try to make a way for himself as a professional jazz musician. And it's we used the word before, but it's such an intimate film. You see, how did they get this? Well, Clark can barely sleep. Clark Terry keeps ridiculous hours, sleeps something like 3 hours a night.
Hmm.
So Alan and his partner would be crashing on the sofa in their home in Arkansas and maybe half awake at 3 a.m. would notice that Justin was gone. He was no longer on the sofa. He'd gone down to Clark's study or his bedroom, and they were woodshedding together or talking or trying things out on the keyboard. And so they woke themselves up, tiptoed downstairs, turned on the camera or cameras, and captured those interactions. It's a beautiful movie. I don't use that term a lot. I think it's a beautiful movie.
It is beautiful, it's a good thing that you say that you don't have to know a lot about jazz.
No,
like I'm a medium jazz buff. I knew who Clark Terry was before this film, and especially a lot of the people whose lives he's touched. Quincy Jones is a big,
he was Quincy's first teacher.
Right. He taught Quincy.
And mentor.
He, a lot of people have come to him. We have Herbie Hancock in the film.
Yep. Yeah.
There's
even a little clip of Miles Davis.
Miles Davis, who said that Clark was one of his first heroes. And you see Clark playing with Count Basie and Duke Ellington. So even if you know a little bit about jazz, you can understand that these are the true name brands.
Yep.
of quote-unquote name brands of jazz. So, but it's not about that. It's about that these people respect this man. Mm-hmm. It's not about them playing all the time. It's about that this man has touched so many lives and has changed so many lives from Quincy Jones on. And this is the latest this kid at the beginning of the film, Justin, is the latest and greatest.
But not the last.
Yes. The latest and greatest in a long line of students, but definitely not the last. Yeah.
It's tough. I don't want to oversell this movie.
Then don't.
but I really do love it. I wish it had been more successful.
Mm.
The people at the Weinstein Company, Radius division of Weinstein Company, acquired the distribution rights, and I think they saw in it another film in the vein of 20 Feet from Stardom, which they released very successfully, and went on to win an Oscar. And I think they thought this might do the same. It didn't. It didn't get the same traction. It wasn't as broadly appealing as the story of 20 Feet from Stardom about those great backup singers. It had a theatrical release, a brief theatrical release. It got attention because Quincy Jones put his name on it as executive producer. and produced the music soundtrack with Dave Grusin, and is a crucial interviewee. But it just didn't take off. It was well received, played some key festivals, but it didn't take off the way I hoped it would. Mm. But that's the beauty now of access to these films, is that you can watch it tonight if you want. You can watch it anytime. You can watch it more than once. There's even a soundtrack album. I got a physical CD.
All right.
Of the soundtrack album, which has some of Clark's
you kept on
music and
on.
Some of Justin's music too.
Great. Yeah.
But primarily, as I say, it's about these two great spirits. One we meet as a teenager, one we meet as an elderly man whose health is failing. And full disclosure, Clark Terry has since passed away since the release of this film. But what a life.
Mm-hmm.
And what a life he lived to the fullest and to the last moment. Drained every last drop. It's quite a story.
This is the movie where community works really well.
Yeah.
This is what's happening here is the bridge from an older generation to a newer generation.
Yeah.
And that it's not a one-way street.
Yep, exactly so.
And it's a beautiful thing to witness, definitely.
So you've asked us to repeat names. We'll repeat the names. The
okay.
three films we have discussed today, all of which we heartily recommend, are The Overnighters.
The Overnighters.
Made by Jesse Moss. Crips and Bloods, Made in America.
Crips and Bloods, Made in America.
By Stacy Peralta. And Keep On Keeping On.
Keep On Keeping On.
Directed by Alan Hicks. And you'll thank us. I think, does that sound cocky? I don't mean it to sound cocky. I think you'll be glad you saw these films.
I think it's fine to sound cocky. Yeah, these are great documentaries.
Yeah.
The end.
Yeah. So that's our show. That's this week's roundup of films. We'll have more next time because there's always more.
Thanks, Clark Terry. So that's the relationship we have. I'm the older generation in the equation, though.
Oh, okay. Whatever you say. I'm not an argumentative mood, you know, so that's fine.
I got you.
But if people are pining, yearning to have more interaction with you before the next podcast, where can they find you, Baron?
Oh, well, I'm on Twitter, BARVONBLAQ. And if you haven't, I think you probably already have, check out Grace and Frankie on Netflix. And what about yourself, Leonard?
You can find me on Twitter at Leonard Maltin. And you can find me online at my website, leonardmaltin.com.
Hey, do you speak about this and that?
I do, this and that.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah, I've been having fun writing about film books and some recent odd and obscure DVD releases, as well as reviewing the new movies. So that's where I do that, leonardmaltin.com. And this is where we talk about movies we like and occasionally movies we don't. So please come back next time. You all hang out with us. And we'll see you then. Take care.
Womp up the jam. Swap it up. Like it is your...
What? This feels really weird without the song.
Tough. Can you at least beatbox?
We can't afford it.
Can you beatbox, bitch?
No, you can't. I can't start the tape over.
Bitch, can you beatbox?
Yeah, sure.
I didn't say do like the mating call of a mountain gorilla, Jane Goodall.
No, that's nailed it.
All right. Hey, I'm Marissa Wampler, and my show is called Womp It Up. We're coming at you from the Marina Del Rey Public High School Library, where I'm a student. And every episode, me and my teacher and quasi-legal guardian.
It's legal in Central and parts of South America.
Whatever. We interview the most fascinating teachers, students, and janitors at my school until I overwhelm them with my movie star charm and my incandescent sexuality. Can we play a clip?
Yeah, here it is.
You're not guilty in the eyes of the law.
All right.
Like O.J. Simpson.
Oh, I don't want to be like O.J. Simpson. That doesn't make me feel good.
Why not? He's a terrific ball player.
Terrific ball player.
Guys.
And a good actor, too.
No, listen.
Not bad.
You're
great
the
wearing
only
gloves.
People, guys, you're the only people who are going to argue in his defense.
I'm not arguing anything. We're just saying that a court of law.
Court of law found him innocent of murder.
So get to earwolf.com for your favorite.
Earwolf.
What'd I say?
.com. Earwolf. Like Alf, your favorite show.
God, I love that show.
Earwolf.com or your favorite podcast app right now and womp up those jams.
Pop.
Pop?
Pop.
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 Wolf Pop is part of Midroll Media, executive produced by Adam Sachs, Matt Gourley, and Paul Scheer.